supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A former Philadelphia Eagle owns up to insider trading. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that his admission comes after federal authorities announced the charges this morning.
Former Eagle Michael Kendricks and investment banker Damian Sanoiki have been charged with insider trading, accused of using non-public information to boost Kendricks' investments by hundreds of thousands of dollars. United States Attorney William McSwain says Sanoiki was feeding inside information to Kendricks, who now plays for the Cleveland Browns.
From July 2013 until May 2015, Mr. Sanoiki was an associate at a global investment bank. Among other things, the investment bank advised clients regarding potential mergers and acquisitions. And Mr. Sanoiki had a fiduciary duty to the investment bank's clients to maintain the confidentiality of ongoing negotiations.
McSwain says the two men used several methods to conceal the insider trading.
Mr. Sanoiki and Mr. Kendricks attempted to cover their tracks, including by using FaceTime to share inside information in an attempt to avoid detection by law enforcement.
Christian Zajac of the FBI says these are serious charges.
This is not gaming the system. It's a federal crime. This was a well-coordinated, scripted effort whereby the subjects employed specific measures to mask their activities. These measures highlighted that Mr. Kendricks and Mr. Sanoiki knew what they were doing was wrong.
Kendricks has issued a statement admitting the insider trading, but saying he invested money with a former friend who he thought he could trust. He insists he did not take any of the profits for himself. So how were they caught? Stephanie Avekian of the Securities Exchange Commission's Enforcement Division says they couldn't cover their tracks in cyberspace.
In this case, members of the SEC's Market Abuse Unit, a specialized group within the Division of Enforcement, were able to link trading in Kendricks' brokerage account with an IP address belonging to Sanoiki, effectively uncovering the investment banker's central role in this scheme.
They're accused of texting in code, talking about football jersey numbers to refer to money, and in one case, meeting at 30th Street Station for a discussion and cash payoff. In addition to cash, prosecutors say Kendricks gave Sanoiki Eagles tickets and invited him to celebrity events to compensate him for the stock tips. The pair could receive a maximum 25 years in jail and more than $5 million in fines based on the charges. Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
New Jersey's top law enforcement official is telling cities and towns across the state that they cannot decriminalize low-level marijuana possession. However, Attorney General Gabeer Grewal is telling prosecutors that they have wide latitude in how to prosecute cases that come across their desks. This is all playing out as New Jersey lawmakers and Governor Phil Murphy work out a plan to legalize recreational marijuana in the state. WHYY's Joe Hernandez has been following the story and joins me now. And Joe, the Attorney General issued new guidelines on marijuana crimes today. But what happened about a month ago that set the stage for today's announcement?
Right. So earlier in July, the top prosecutor in Jersey City announced he wasn't going to prosecute low-level marijuana possession. So a New Jersey municipal court is where you go for things like traffic tickets and minor drug crimes, that sort of thing. After the Jersey City prosecutor announced this, State Attorney General Gabeer Grewal said, no, you can't do that. He said, if there's a state law that says some kind of behavior is outlawed, then cops and prosecutors have to enforce that law. But when this happened in July, Grewal said, listen, I hear what you're saying. Let's hit pause on these low-level marijuana prosecutions for a month, and we'll convene a working group to figure out how to treat this crime going forward.
So given that perspective, what happened today?
So today, Grewal announced his decision. And, you know, one main takeaway is that he reaffirmed the idea that cities and towns can't simply decriminalize things. They have to follow the law, whether they like it or not. But the big caveat to that is that prosecutors have discretion when it comes to these low-level marijuana cases. So, for example, municipal prosecutors in New Jersey can choose to dismiss or downgrade charges in certain circumstances when they have, quote, good cause. So that could be if a conviction might affect a defendant's educational or job prospects, or if it might harm their immigration proceedings. Prosecutors can also, after someone has been convicted, petition a judge for a more lenient sentence or back a defendant's bid to avoid having their driver's license suspended, which happens often. Graywall held a press conference with reporters this morning, and here's what he had to say.
Municipal prosecutors can contribute responsibly to progressive criminal justice reform while respecting the rule of law, including the authority of the legislature and the courts. Again, municipal prosecutors cannot decriminalize conduct that the legislature has criminalized.
By way of response, have we heard from other law enforcement officials in the state or municipal prosecutors?
Yeah, several people I spoke to today said what Graywall announced made sense. And I think to many people in the legal profession, it's probably not all that controversial. I mean, the gist is that prosecutors have to enforce existing laws, but they have discretion in how to do that. I think one of the things that's interesting about this is that it seems kind of like the Attorney General's office is signaling some ways for prosecutors to prioritize their work. So maybe you don't need to charge these low-level offenses as aggressively, and that will free you up to net some larger offenders. I talked to Reed Gassiora. He's the mayor of Trenton now, but he was a state assemblyman before that and also a municipal prosecutor.
90% of the marijuana arrests are that roach in the ashtray, so there it's a de minimis amount. Sometimes I've seen arrests for marijuana fleck on someone's jacket. So what Attorney General Gruhl is intimating is that we should go after the high-level offenses.
I also talked to Jersey City Mayor Steve Phillips. So remember, this all started because Jersey City attempted to decriminalize low-level marijuana possession. I told him that this morning Attorney General Graywall on the conference call reiterated that places like Jersey City couldn't just decriminalize low-level marijuana possession. And his reaction kind of surprised me. Phillips said that what the AG announced today was exactly what the city was hoping for.
You know, when somebody gets on a conference call and they say, well, we won't let this, but we'll allow this, and the end goal is exactly what we intended, I think anybody can see that, you know, we kind of navigated this course in a way to virtually decriminalize marijuana.
But, Joe, meanwhile, Governor Phil Murphy and the state legislature are trying to legalize recreational marijuana. What are the impediments to that moving forward?
I don't know. Governor Phil Murphy campaigned on this. He said he wanted to legalize recreational marijuana. He said the benefits would be at least twofold, that the state would get additional tax revenue and that it's also a social justice issue. There's a 2013 report from the ACLU that found that blacks were arrested in New Jersey at three times the rates of whites for marijuana possession. And as you mentioned, top lawmakers in the legislature seem to support this idea as well. So just so far, there's been no single plan that's gotten consensus from everybody, but it's something to look out for the rest of the year.
Thanks, Joe.
Thank you, Dave.
WHYY's Joe Hernandez on Newsworks Tonight. A confrontation is heating up between the Trump administration and the city of Philadelphia over opening a facility where opioid users can inject drugs under the eye of medical staff. U.S. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein tells WHYY that if Philadelphia opens a so-called supervised injection site, the federal response will be swift and aggressive. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports that top city officials say that threat will not stop them from forging ahead with the controversial plan.
The thorny legal issues surrounding so-called supervised injection sites have been a top concern for Philadelphia leaders. How would the federal government respond when the city launches a medical site for people to inject drugs? The Trump administration has been mum on the subject until Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein sat down with WHYY.
If local governments get in the business of facilitating drug use, of telling people we're going to help you, not just handing out needles, because they're not just handing out needles, they're actually inviting people to bring these illegal drugs into their places of business. If you start down that road, you're really going to undermine the deterrent message that I think is so important in order to prevent people from becoming addicted in the future.
Rosenstein says drug users struggling with opioid addiction need treatment, not more access to a deadly drug. He says that's especially true in neighborhoods like Kensington, where the drug trade is brisk and plenty of drug users are living on the streets.
You can't possibly think you're going to solve the problem that you've described in Kensington by setting up a a place where people can actually come and legally, at least with the sanction of the local government, inject drugs.
Because even if local leaders approve, the Justice Department does not. His advice to Mayor Jim Kenney and other top elected officials: you better start consulting your lawyers.
I'm not aware of any valid basis for the argument that you can engage in criminal activity as long as you do it in the presence of somebody with a medical license.
Rosenstein says he's never visited one of the more than 100 supervised injection sites that operate around the world. But he says the idea of allowing someone to bring their own drugs into a city-sanctioned space troubles him.
This is a black market that often involves violence. And so you're bringing all that into one neighborhood where you open up this injection site. So that's one of the immediate concrete harms. But as I said, the more significant thing is the unintended consequences in terms of the message that you're sending to the broader community.
Rosenstein said he, quote, wouldn't speculate on what exactly the enforcement would look like or who could get arrested. But he confirms that federal officials have their eye trained on Philadelphia. City leaders, he says, should expect legal action as soon as the city opens a facility. In the face of the new high-level threats from the Justice Department, Philadelphia city leaders say, consider the numbers. More than 1,200 people died in the city last year of a drug overdose, mostly from opioids. That's 35% worse than the deadliest time of the AIDS epidemic, says Philadelphia Health Commissioner Thomas Farley. He says the city's opioid crisis is different and demands action otherwise.
So this would be the worst public health crisis in a century.
Farley says it's disappointing that the Justice Department is taking this position so publicly, but it's not going to sidetrack Philadelphia's plans. Farley says the evidence is clear. In countries that have opened supervised injection sites, overdose deaths have dropped.
In a crisis like this, with as many people dying as we have, it's worth a try.
That's a message that was on display at Philadelphia City Hall this afternoon as dozens of supervised injection site supporters rallied to pressure leaders to act more quickly. Sandra Collette was among them. She's in recovery and recently lost her partner to an overdose. She says after repeatedly seeing piles of used needles and people openly using opioids near her Kensington bus stop, she became a supporter of the facilities.
That finally woke me up and said maybe, just maybe, a safe injection site would work, you know? Because this is not just one person's problem. This is all our problem.
The exact timing of Philadelphia's supervised injection site has not been announced. It could be a mobile site, it could be a normal building, or it could be a pop-up site on a vacant lot. Officials say perhaps as soon as the end of the year, there will be another major announcement. Meanwhile, justice officials have other cities and states to watch. California just passed a bill legalizing supervised injection sites. Rosenstein says he's well aware. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
With the summer vacation season winding down, workers and students contemplating getting where they're going might find a challenge if they're doing so in New Jersey, where public transit commuters have endured many train cancellations and delays this summer. Let's punch our ticket with Larry Higgs, commuter writer for NJ Advanced Media. Larry, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
My pleasure.
Before we get to what lies ahead, let's look back for a moment. What's caused all these cancellations and delays?
In a word, positive train control, otherwise known as PTC. It's federally mandated. Every railroad has to have it installed by the end of the year. And if they don't, they face fines if they continue operating trains. Now, the problem is NJ Transit has had some problems with their contractor, Parsons. And when the new transportation commissioner took office this year, she sat down with the Federal Railroad Administration. She sat down with Parsons, and they ironed out a new contract, which has significant penalties if they don't meet the December 31st deadline. Right now, it's a race for NJ Transit to get finished. NJ Transit says it's 58% complete with installing positive train control in cars, training employees, and putting equipment out on the tracks. The problem is they have a long way to go. Out of 282 locomotives and cab cars, they finished installing PTC equipment on 100 of them, and 182 remain. So what that means for commuters is that they're going to have to take 30 to 40 trains, locomotives and cab cars, out of service during the second half of 2018 to finish installing all this equipment. And what that means is you're going to see more trains canceled due to a lack of equipment. In fact, today, NJ Transit has just canceled a Northeast Corridor Line train citing the lack of equipment due to PTC installation. So it's going to get worse.
Commuters understandably look for reliability, predictability. Can't NJ Transit put out a reduced schedule so there's some transparency?
It's a good question, and some transit advocates have suggested that. They've said rather than playing this cat and mouse game of, oh, I'm here for my train, now I find out on the platform it's canceled, now I either have to wait or find another way to work, they've said just put out a reduced schedule, kind of similar to what they did last year during the infamous Summer of Hell, which wasn't so hellish. They reduced trains, and commuters had an idea of what they could expect to ride on. Now, NJ Transit has reduced some service. They made schedule changes to about 15 trains. Some have been canceled. Some have been combined with others. It's not enough, clearly. We're still seeing some canceled trains.
Let's focus specifically on trains in our region, starting off with the Atlantic City line.
The Atlantic City line is kind of a rarity because it's one of the first times an entire line has been shut down to install positive train control. And that's kind of raised some fears among transit advocates and commuters who are afraid that once it goes away, it's not going to come back. Now, NJ Transit officials have said the line is going to come back, that there's no reason why they would make the investment, which includes putting some new rail down, just to shut it down. But the problem is, once you shut the line down, the riders are going to find another way to work, and when they resume service on the line, they may not come back. So ridership declines. Once ridership declines, NJ Transit may reduce service even further, which is going to take more riders off the line when they find it's not as convenient. And it just keeps spiraling until sooner or later they may shut it down. So that's the fear.
Presumably, the spiral you're describing doesn't apply to train commuters who are departing Trenton, Mercer, and Burlington counties heading north.
No, that's the Northeast Corridor line. This would strictly be the Atlantic City line because the Atlantic City line is basically, it's a line all to itself. It doesn't connect to the rest of NJ Transit system. It makes it kind of an orphan. And the other thing that's happening is all the equipment is being set up north, presumably to have PTC equipment installed on it, but the crews may also go up north. And that's another thing that makes commuters wonder, was this just done to bail out the problems on NJ Transit's other lines?
I know Governor Murphy blames a lot of the problems that he's inherited on the Christie administration that preceded him.
He does, and that is with merit. There's been a lot of talk amongst commuters about Governor Christie being tone deaf. One of the most famous Twitter exchanges was during a massive outage and hour-long delays at Penn Station on a Friday night, and the governor tweeted to commuters, "Hang in there," and that tweet has been repeated often whenever there's a problem as kind of an indication of being tone deaf. Now, Governor Murphy hasn't escaped because he was on vacation in Italy, and unfortunately his social media people put out a boilerplate tweet about how much he's accomplished trying to fix some of the problems at NJ Transit. And a lot of them felt that he should have come back from Italy when a lot of these trains started being canceled. They had 20 trains canceled in one day, and they felt he should have cut his vacation short and come back. But at the very least, he shouldn't have kept letting his people put those tweets out saying what they have accomplished with NJ Transit.
Larry, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
My pleasure.
Larry Higgs is commuter writer for NJ Advance Media. In Delaware's largest school district, Superintendent Merv Daugherty has been an omnipresent force for a decade. He created and nurtured innovative programs to help his Red Clay district keep and attract students, even as other districts lose them to charter schools. But now he's leaving for a vastly larger district near Richmond, Virginia. WHYY's Chris Barish reports.
If you attend an event in the Red Clay School District, recital, family night, football game, Merv Daugherty will likely be there. A large, low-key man with a perpetual smile, he chats amiably with everyone he encounters and listens to them, says board member Adriana Bohm.
He's fabulous. He knows everyone. People from all walks of life, all different ages, black people, white people, Latinos, Asians, and he knows them by name, and he goes up and he asks about their family and their kids. I just think he's really genuine.
Daugherty has also been successful at Red Clay, where he began as an assistant principal in 2000. He started niche programs like culinary arts or an early college academy at traditional high schools. He oversaw top-performing institutions like Conrad Schools of Science. He's been planning a high school solely for kids with drug addiction, but he knows more must be done when he leaves November 1st.
Education, you never finish. Really working hard to address the issues that come with poverty and trauma. We still have a lot to do. I know that the district's going to continue to push that issue. I want my legacy just to be that I was a person who really cared about the kids coming to the schools.
Boehm, a frequent district critic before she joined the board, says Daugherty always seeks a solution.
I think he listens to criticism and takes criticism really well. And I think he goes back and rethinks about maybe a better way we could introduce something or roll something out. Now, Merv and I don't always agree on everything, but we can have really frank, candid conversations. I really, really respect him.
The board is now weighing plans for finding a successor. From the Delaware Desk, Chris Barish, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on your favorite podcast app or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.